Are you aware of another time they were together? I know that Jamal was planning to have her come over the morning of the tubing trip down to Itchtuckney.
How do you know that?
He asked me to make sure every brother in the house went on the tubing trip so he and Shelley would be alone.
And so that their secret relationship would remain a secret, right?
Yes. Another pause and another flip of the page. The prosecutor continued.
Mr. Wall, did you ever tell anyone what you saw that day?
Never. Well, not until after Jamal was dead, when you and I talked.
Did you ever discuss it with Jamal?
I did.
What was the gist of that conversation?
Jamal didn't want me to tell anyone about him and Shelley.
Did he tell you why?
Objection, said Jack, having let this go far enough. That's clearly hearsay, Your Honor.
There were a few groans from the gallery as if Jack should be disbarred. The judge sighed and said,
Technically, you may be right, Mr. Swiatek, but there's no jury here. I'll allow the witness to answer and decide later if I should disregard it.
Jack settled into his seat. It was a damned-if-he-did, damned-if-he-didn't situation, and there was nothing more to do.
You can answer the question, Bolt told the witness.
Brandon leaned closer to the microphone, but his lips didn't move. The prosecutor clearly had an answer in mind. Jack imagined it was a zinger along the lines of, Jamal feared retaliation by her racist brother Mark.
Mr. Wall, the prosecutor nudged. Why did Jamal's cousin not want anyone to know?
Brandon's struggle was on display for the entire courtroom. It was like watching a man getting ready to yank out a fractured tooth. Finally, he answered.
Jamal said, it would kill Shelley's mother if anyone knew.
The answer was perhaps more shocking than anything that came before, hitting Jack like a mule kick. Then, just as suddenly, Jack recalled the way he and Liz had laughed and then cried over the satirical study that the nurse had told her about in the hospital, that racism was hereditary. The prosecutor was staring at Brandon, and he appeared less than fully satisfied. It was plain to Jack that it would kill Shelley's mother was not the answer that the state attorney had expected, not what they'd rehearsed in witness prep. Finally, Bolt thanked the witness and stepped away, accepting what Brandon was willing to give him.
Your Honor, I have no further questions, he said, and he returned to his seat.
The judge looked at Jack.
Well...
His words of judicial wisdom pretty much summed up Jack's feelings. Jack rose.
Your Honor,
save your breath, the judge said. That went longer than anticipated. Let's break for the day.
Jack could not have been more appreciative. Thank you, Judge.
We'll start with your cross-examination at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, Judge Teague said. Mr. Wall, you are still under oath. Do not discuss your testimony with anyone overnight. We are adjourned.
The crack of the judge's gavel cut through the courtroom and all rose on the bailiff's command. Judge Teague stepped down from the bench, and Jack wished that the walk to his chambers were not so short. Jack didn't want to deal with the rush of the media to the rail. He had no appetite for a gloating state attorney. And he was dreading the expressions he would see when he turned around and looked at Mark's family. The side door closed, Judge Teague was gone, and all that Jack would have rather lived without immediately came to pass. Jack stayed close to his client, ignoring the flurry of questions from reporters.
Mrs. Townsend, are you a racist? Did you teach hate to your son, Mrs. Townsend?
Mark's parents appeared numb. But Shelley took off like a rocket, running toward the exit. Jack's gaze followed her all the way to the double doors at the rear, where she paused ever so slightly, but long enough for Jack to notice. She looked at the old, very old African-American man with the snow-white hair who had entered the courtroom just before Brandon's testimony and taken the last open seat in the last row. It all happened in a flash, but it played in Jack's mind as if in slow motion. And Jack was sure of one thing. Mark's sister and that old man had met before.
Chapter 68. Jack left the courthouse without comment for the media and went straight to the Suwanee County Jail. Mark didn't look him in the eye when he entered the attorney-client conference room. Even after taking a seat at the table, Mark's gaze was still aimed at the floor.
"When did Shelley tell you about her and Jamal?" asked Jack.
Mark took a deep breath.
"Last week, when she came to visit me. Mark, I told you and Shelley that conversations with any visitor but your attorney are recorded. Shelley knew that. That's why she didn't say it out loud. Damn it, Mark, they read letters too. She didn't write it in a letter," said Mark.
He told Jack about the scripted message on her arm that looked like a tattoo.
"It was in French," said Mark.
It would have been somewhat clever if similar stunts weren't pulled every day in prisons all over the world.
"What did it say?" asked Jack. "JC was my love, BR knew." JC was clearly Jamal's cousin. BR. Bane Robinson knew? That's what Shelley said. In fact, right before she showed me the message, she said it was about Bane.
Jack thought for a moment.
That's why Bane sent the text messages to Jamal. Shit, Mark. Shelley should have told me this. This isn't the kind of thing you try to sneak past corrections officers. Obviously, she was leaving it up to me. Leaving what up to you? Whether to let Mom hear it before she dies.
The prognosis didn't surprise Jack. He'd been worried for Liz. The surprise was in the fuller implication of what Mark was saying.
So what Brandon Wall said is true? It would have killed your mother to know?
Mark's eyes welled.
I love my mother, Jack. She's a kind, wonderful person. But it's okay, said Jack. I get it.
Silence hovered between them. Jack recalled his conversation with Mark's father, who regretted the missed opportunity to show his 10-year-old son the courage to reject all those bad influences that say it's okay to be racist. It had never occurred to Jack that Tucker's own wife was among the bad influences.
You understand the problem we have now, right? Asked Jack. I think I do.
Where there was once no motive at all for you to taunt and then lynch Jamal's cousin, there is now the oldest and most stereotypical motive in the history of black-white relations.
I understand. I have to call Shelley to the witness stand.
She has to explain that you knew nothing about her and Jamal until she visited you in jail.
But understand this, not a single person in that courtroom is going to believe her. Maybe not even your parents. It's going to come across as a sister who loves her brother and will say anything to save his life.
I'm sorry, said Mark.
So am I, said Jack. And then a thought occurred to him. Unless what? It's possible. A surveillance camera captured Shelley showing you the message on her arm. How does that help? If the camera caught Shelley telling you about JC after you're in jail, it proves that you didn't know. That negates your motive to send that text message to Jamal and to have anything to do with the lynching. Do you think it's on video? My guess is that the jail has a surveillance camera that snaps an image every 8 seconds or at some set interval like that. The question is whether the message in her arm will be readable. Can you get the images? Jack rose, no time to waste. I'll ask right now. Then what? Then I need to have a talk with your sister. Jack could have walked from the jail to his motel, but driving was the only way to make sure he wouldn't end up on television with a microphone shoved in his face. Theo had flown back to Miami with Riley that morning, but Shelley still had the room next to Jack's. She was alone when she answered Jack's knock. She sat on the ottoman next to the noisy climate control unit built into the wall. Jack pulled up the desk chair. Mark told me everything he knows, said Jack. And there's not much to talk about, is there? She said. We both know that's not the case. She looked at Jack, but he could see that she'd been crying. Then she looked away. Bane Robinson is a pig. How did he find out about you and Jamal? I have no idea. He wouldn't tell me who his source was. But he told you he knew. She chuckled mirthlessly. Told me is a nice way to put it. What do you mean? There's a history with me and Bane. I was a very stupid freshman. I made out with him one night at the Theta House. Terrible mistake. It was the biggest lecture Mark ever gave me. Anyway, I totally blew off Bane. He kept after me, but I was always like, see you, Bane. She sighed, her voice filling with regret. Then he had this over me. You and Jamal? Yeah. He wants me to sleep with him, or he would tell my mother. I told you he was a pig. How did Bane know that your mother...
Jack stopped himself, searching for the right words.
How did he know that your mother would have such a big problem with Jamal?
First of all, Bane is himself a racist. It's like they can sniff each other out. Of all Mark's friends, the only one my mother would make an inappropriate remark in front of was Bane. They kind of had a thing that they shared.
A thing?
It was like their own sense of humor, a private joke between them.
I'm not sure I understand.
Here's what I'm saying. One time last year, there was a group of Mark's friends over at our house watching a Gator game on television. My parents and I were in the room watching, too. There was a black play-by-play announcer, a former player. To be totally honest, he was really struggling. Most of us were like, okay, it's his first time on television. The poor guy's really nervous, whatever. But Bane, well, he had a few beers. And he would break into this exaggerated yowza imitation every time the announcer said anything. Yowza? Yowza, master referee. Yowza, master alligator mascot.
Oh.
It got to the point that we were all telling him to shut the hell up, but Mom, she was noticeably silent. I hate to say this. I love my mom. But I could tell that she thought Bane was funny. Something inside her wanted to burst out laughing. I had to leave the room. Everybody thought it was because of Bane, but that wasn't it.
For the first time in my life, I was ashamed of my own mother.
Jack felt her pain. There were things his own father had done, things that had driven them apart when Jack was a young lawyer. He wished he could have told her that it's possible to work out these differences over time, but time was short in the Townsend family. That made it all the more difficult to ask the question that Jack felt compelled to ask.
Shelley, please don't get mad, but you said earlier that Bane threatened to tell your mother.
I didn't sleep with him, if that's your question.
It wasn't, but the fact that you didn't give in to his demand makes the question all the more important. Is it possible that Bane did tell your mother?
Shelley considered it for a moment, but her thoughts quickly returned to resentment.
Seriously? Are you asking me if I think my mother lynched Jamal?
Or encouraged someone else to do it.
Never mind, said Jack. I was having one of those everyone's a suspect moments. Forget I said it.
I will, she said.
And I think you should too.
There was silence between them. Jack decided not to pursue it any further. At least, not with Shelley.
One last question, said Jack.
What?
Who was the old black man in the back of the courtroom today?
Chapter 69. The sun was setting over southern Georgia, and Andy could hear the sounds of creeping nightfall on the Okefenokee Swamp. She also heard rumblings among the Aryan National Alliance rank and file. Since the move to Okefenokee, she'd met Alliance supporters from at least a dozen states, some of whom had traveled hundreds of miles to join the camp, all drawn by the prospect of a showdown with black frat boys. So far, the closest thing to any form of action had been Steger's speeches.
Talk is cheap, said William. Time to crack some heads.
Tonight's speech was again given in the tin-roof shelter. Andy was seated beside William, trying to listen to Steger, but there were whispers of discontent around her.
I agree, said the man behind her and William. I'm tired of sitting around.
The sentiment was generally expressed in quiet exchanges between men who knew each other well. If Steger was aware of the growing dissatisfaction, it didn't stop him from talking. Andy just listened. This speech was of particular interest to her. It was classic Steger, the pseudo-intellectualism that had inspired the naming of FBI Operation 777. On July 7th, 2016, a black man opened fire on Dallas police officers, Steger told the group. His victims were white and black, but make no mistake about his purpose. During the shootout, Micah Xavier Johnson told police by phone that he wanted to kill white people, especially white officers.
Steger paused.
He wasn't addressing a crowd of news junkies, but no one would forget the day that bullets rained down on a peaceful hashtag Black Lives Matter protest in downtown Dallas.
Johnson was shot and wounded in the exchange of gunfire, said Steger, but he was determined to fight to the death. Before an explosive robot was sent in to blow him to bits, he used his own blood to write two letters on the wall. R.B. Now, the liberal media will have you believe Johnson was a lone wolf. No connection to any organization, they say. Let's take a closer look. First, note the significance of the date. The seventh day, the seventh month, the 16th year, 1-6. How much is 1 plus 6? What three-number combination does that date give us? 7-7-7.
Andy discreetly gauged the crowd's reaction. The 777 gimmick had caught their attention.
Steger continued.
Interesting, you say, but so what? Could be a meaningless coincidence, or is it? What about those letters RB, which Micah Johnson wrote in his own blood? The official investigation concluded that they have no significance. Don't believe it. RB is the symbol for rubidium, a chemical element. Scientists describe rubidium as highly reactive. You bet it is. But more important, do you know what the atomic number is for rubidium? 37. Or say it another way, 37. It sounds a lot like three sevens, doesn't it? Again, 7, 7, 7. All this talk of sevens is not just a numbers game. It means something. It tells you what is really afoot.
Andy knew what was coming. For Steger, the hate speech always followed the false intellectual premise.
Islam describes the numerical miracle of the number 7, said Steger. On the trip to Mecca, Muslims cast the traditional 7 stones at the devil. I don't mean to get silly about this, but this will show you the depth of meaning that this number has for the Muslim-inspired black nationalist movement. Malcolm X was in Miami Beach in 1964 to watch Cassius Clay, later Muhammad Ali, take the heavyweight crown from one of the greatest boxers of all time, Sonny Liston. You know what seat Malcolm X selected to watch that fight? You guessed it, seat 7. Do not for a minute believe that Micah Johnson was a lone wolf. Do not underestimate the danger of radical Islam and the influence it has on black nationalism in this country. Again, we can look at the words of Malcolm X himself to prove my point. He was at the height of his career when other black Muslims were turning against him and threatening his life.
Steger opened the book again.
Chapter 16. I knew that no one would kill you quicker than a Muslim if he felt that's what Allah wanted him to do.
Steger laid the book aside, and Annie noticed that there were two books Steger carried everywhere, the Bible and the autobiography of Malcolm X. She noted that he never carried the Quran or referenced its text. His understanding of Islam was typical of a hate monger, based on out-of-context quotes taken from secular writings.
My friends, said Steger, Malcolm X's written words foreshadowed his own death. Don't let them foreshadow yours.
Applause followed, but it was not thunderous. It was lukewarm at best.
Hey, Steger!
A man shouted. Andy glanced over. It was Colt.
Do you have something to say?
Asked Steger.
Yeah, I do. When are we actually gonna do something? I'm tired of sitting around.
The crowd joined in, some members voicing their agreement and others applauding for Colt. Much more applause than Steger's speech had garnered. Steger raised his hands to quiet the crowd.
That's a fair question. Yeah, said Colt. How about a fair fucking answer?
Steger glared, long enough and with enough intensity to silence Colt and those who were egging him on. When the crowd was completely still, he spoke in the dramatic tone of a prophet.
In 24 hours, all the waiting will be over, he said. It's going to be so big, huge, and each of you will know what to do. Believe me.
Steger grabbed his books and stepped off the makeshift stage. The crowd broke into small clusters of conversation. The mood among the rank and file had shifted. Andy could feel the energy and the urgency. Chapter 70. Jack met with Oliver Bolt at the state attorney's office.
The cardboard takeout box was still on the prosecutor's desk, but even without it, Jack would have guessed pizza for dinner. The greasy pepperoni stain was still on the wrinkled white shirt that the state attorney had worn to court that day.
"I have everything you asked for," said Bolt, handing Jack a large manila envelope.
Jack had subpoenaed the Suwanee County Jail to get the surveillance tapes from Shelley's conversation with her brother. He'd scheduled a meeting with Bolt to make it clear that he needed them immediately. He hadn't expected such quick compliance. Jack peeked inside the envelope and saw a flash drive and a CD. "This is everything?" he asked, still skeptical. "All audio, video, and still images?"
"Yes, sir, and in the spirit of cooperation, I went one step further,"
Bolt said, as he handed Jack another envelope across his desk. Jack opened the envelope and removed a photograph. It was a magnified image of the message on Shelley's arm. Jack looked up. The prosecutor seemed curiously smug.
"You know about this?" asked Jack.
"Before you did," said Bolt. "The audio recorded her saying it's about Bane, and then in the next frame of video surveillance, she rolled up her sleeve. Not exactly discreet. We've seen that trick before."
Jack looked again at the magnified image. It was exactly as Mark had described.
"Oliver, you look strangely at peace for a prosecutor who has just handed over irrefutable proof that Mark Towson was completely unaware of the relationship between his sister and Jamal Cousin."
"Irrefutable," he said, smiling. "I think not."
In a case filled with excess footwear, Jack sensed that yet another shoe was about to drop.
"As you might expect," said Bolt, "I spoke to Ben Robinson and his lawyer about this."
"When?"
"An hour ago. Mr. Robinson admits that he knew."
"Which is exactly what the message from Shelley shows," said Jack. "Bane knew. Mark didn't."
"Not exactly," said Bolt. "When Shelley visited her brother in jail, she was apparently unaware of the fact that her brother already knew about her and JC.
"That's not true," said Jack.
Bolt slid a third envelope across his desk. Inside was a signed affidavit from Bane Robinson. Bolt explained the highlights as Jack skimmed it.
"Bane Robinson told Mark Towson that his sister was doing the president of the Alpha House, to use Bane's words. As it states in the affidavit, that conversation took place before Mark Towson sent his text message, and well before the lynching of Jamal Cousin."
Jack laid the affidavit on the desk, looked straight at the prosecutor, and said,
"Bane's lying."
"Your client's lying to you, Jack. Which is the real point of this meeting? You brought me here to gloat to my face? Is that it?"
"Not at all," Bolt said, his expression turning very serious.
"I brought you here because this case is doing terrible things to this community. It's not good for Live Oak, not good for the people of Suwanee County, not good for anybody."
"Are you offering a deal, Oliver?"
The state attorney leaned forward, his forearms resting on the leather desktop.
"Yes."
The two lawyers locked eyes. Then the prosecutor reached inside his suit jacket, pulled a letter-sized envelope from his pocket, and slid it across the desk. He left his hand on the sealed envelope, maintaining his eye contact with Jack.
"This is the only deal I am ever going to offer,"
Bolt said, and then he slowly retracted his hand and settled back into his chair. Jack looked at the envelope but didn't open it. A minute passed. Finally, Jack took it, tucked it away in his coat pocket, and then rose.
"Good night, Oliver,"
he said, offering his hand.
The men shook hands, and Jack left the office with much more than he'd expected. Chapter 71. Percy sensed it was time. It was night. He could tell. It was a new ability he developed. Percy was in constant darkness, except when his captor came to feed him or empty his bucket. But over the past few days, he'd learned to distinguish between the pitch blackness of night and the slightly less complete darkness of daytime, when from some place in the shed that was outside his line of sight, a minuscule amount of sunlight seeped through rotting boards or perhaps a crack in the roof. If his figurative clock was correct, it was nearing dinner time, and his captor would arrive soon. And then Percy would make his move. There had been plenty of time to plan. Each time his captor switched on the light, Percy stole a glimpse of his surroundings. When the light went out, he replayed the image in his mind. He knew how many steps it was to the door. He knew exactly where the light bulb was, the length of the exposed wire from the rafters, and how high the bulb dangled above the concrete floor. Most important, he knew where the tool bench was and which tools might be of greatest use. Footsteps. They were right outside the shed. Right on time. Percy drew a breath to calm his nerves. He knew what he had to do and there was no backing down. He'd been told from the outset that he would live only if Jamal's killers went free. Seeing his first captor's face had erased even that small hope. His replacement had given Percy the name Emmett, and Percy was keenly aware of how the story of Emmett Till had ended. He heard the lock turn from the outside. The door creaked open and the blinding beam of a flashlight hit him squarely in the eyes. He heard the door close, the click of the light switch. The flashlight went off and Percy was in the yellowish glow of the bulb dangling above him.
"Be still," the man said.
Percy sat in silence, waiting for precisely the right moment. The man came toward him. Percy was at the ready. Hours of work were about to pay off. His ankles were still shackled. The only chain binding him to the wall had been the wrist shackles, which his captors had fed through a neatly drilled hole in the exposed stud. Percy had worked tirelessly since his last meal, using the chain like a cable saw to cut through the 2x4. With wrists chained together but no longer tethered to the wall, Percy swung the 2-foot length of steel chain with all his arm strength, striking his captor across the side of the head.
"Fuck!"
the man shouted as he fell to the floor. It was a punishing blow, but not enough to knock him out. His captor tried to squirm away from him, and Percy knew that only one of them was going to leave this shed alive. Percy stretched his body, extending his reach as far as possible, and wrapped the chain around the man's neck. And then he squeezed. The man grunted, clawed, and kicked, but Percy only squeezed with more force. Tighter than he thought possible, as if this were about more than just saving himself. The man went limp. Percy maintained the tension on the chain for a moment longer, then released. His captor didn't move. Percy fell back into the concrete, exhausted, but there was no time to catch his breath. He went to the tool bench, grabbed a hatchet, and sat back down on the floor. He raised the hatchet above his head, took aim at the chain between his ankles, and swung down. It barely made a dent in the steel link. His captor groaned. The man didn't move, but he was still alive. A part of Percy wanted to walk across the shed and bury that hatchet right in that fucking racist's head. Another part told him that there was a difference between fighting off an attacker and crushing the skull of an unconscious human being. He rummaged through the tools on the bench and found a hacksaw. There was enough slack in the ankle chain for him to shuffle to a safer place where he could stop and cut through the links. He took the hatchet, too. Then he hurried out the door and stepped into the night, realizing that he had no idea where he was or where he was going. Chapter 72. Jack knew every crack in the sidewalks along Ohio Avenue. Too many times he'd walked the same triangle of downtown Live Oak since breakfast, the courthouse to the jail to the state attorney's office. This would be his final visit of the night with his client, but there was so much more to be done before court resumed in the morning. "Bane's not lying," Mark said softly. "He did tell me about Jamal and Shelley." It was like having the wind knocked out of him. "So when I asked you when you found out about your sister and Jamal, you lied to me?" "No. The question you asked was, when did Shelley tell you about her and Jamal? I told you when she came to visit me last week." Jack did all he could to control his anger. "Don't fuck with me, Mark. You sat there and pretended like you didn't know a thing until Shelley told you. You deceived me, and you'd better have a good explanation or we're done." Mark slumped even deeper in his chair. There's no excuse." "I didn't ask for an excuse. I need to know why you did this." "Okay. The truth is, I..." He drew a breath as if trying to start again. "I was trying to tell you, but then you got excited and said the surveillance video of Shelley's visit could be the break we're looking for. If we could prove that I didn't know about Shelley and Jamal until after Jamal was dead, all this might go away." "It can't make anything go away if it's not true. How did you not realize that the truth would come out?"
Mark hung his head, running his fingers through his hair.
"Honestly, I never thought Bane would admit that he knew. Doesn't it make him look guilty?" "It makes you look guilty, Mark, because he told you. Damn it! The one thing I told you never to do is lie to me."
Mark suddenly seemed much younger than he was, like a schoolboy dressed down by the principal.
"It wasn't that big a lie," he muttered. "You're charged with a racially motivated lynching. If you knew your sister was sleeping with the victim, you had motive." "This is all so ridiculous. First off, I would have absolutely no problem with Shelley dating Jamal if she wanted to. But even if I was a racist, what Bane told me wouldn't have even mattered." "How could it not matter? Because I didn't believe him. Why not?"
Mark looked exhausted, physically and emotionally, but he pushed through it.
"Do you remember what Bane told us at that first meeting we had with him and his lawyer?" "Told us about what?" "That run-in he had with Brandon Wall at the Theta House last spring. Brandon was hired as the bartender for our party. He quit when he found out Bane wanted to serve strange fruit cocktails. What does that have to do with this? When I first heard about Shelley and Jamal, I thought it was just Brandon tweaking Bane. Bane is not the most enlightened Theta brother when it comes to race. Telling Bane that my sister blew him off to sleep with the black president of the Alpha House is a surefire way to piss him off."
"Hold it," said Jack. "It was Brandon who told him? That's how Bane found out."
"That's what Bane said, but Brandon testified today that he never told anyone."
"Then he lied," said Mark.
It wasn't at all clear why Brandon would have lied, but Jack's head was spinning.
"I don't know the truth anymore.
All I can say is that I'm completely disappointed in you."
Mark glowered, and his expression changed from utter embarrassment and remorse to one of pure anger. It was more than he could contain.
Mark sprang from his chair and started pacing furiously from one side of the small room to the other.
Mark, sit down.
Seriously, that's your reaction? Mark asked, his anger rising.
You're disappointed in me!
Mark, get control of yourself. Mark stopped and glared, almost shouting.
My mother is dying, okay? I've been expelled from college? My fraternity burned to the ground? One of my closest friends died less than a foot away from me in a car accident, and my own fraternity brother is making shit up about me to save his own ass. I could get the death penalty for lynching the guy my sister couldn't even tell our mother she was in love with. And even if I'm acquitted, which I should be, I'll still be known as the worst racist of the 21st century. To top it all off, I'm locked up every day in solitary confinement because my Nazi cellmate, who literally has swastikas tattooed onto his balls, tried to shove his cock down my throat.
Mark, calm down.
No, I won't! For a split second in our meeting, I saw a way out of this and I made a mistake, so fuck you, Jack! Fuck you and you, oh, Mark, how could you lie to me bullshit?
Mark went to the exit and buzzed for the guard. The door opened and the guard entered, but Jack told him to leave. When he was gone, Jack allowed Mark the time he needed to cool down. Then he spoke.
I have something I want you to look at, said Jack, as he laid the envelope from the state attorney on the table. Bolt offered us a deal.
What kind of deal?
If you plead guilty to first-degree murder, he'll recommend life in prison with no parole. You avoid the death penalty.
That's it?
Mark asked, incredulous.
That's his offer?
Yes.
And now you think I should take it, right? I lied to you, so I deserve to spend the rest of my life in solitary confinement? Is that where we are now?
No, it's not, said Jack, looking his client in the eye.
I'm sorry, all right. Come, sit down. My advice is to tell Oliver Bolt that the answer is no. Hell no, in fact.
Mark took a second to regain his composure.
Okay. And that's what we'll do.
Good.
Jack said in a warmer tone. Now try to get some rest tonight. We have a big day tomorrow.
Chapter 73. Andy and her undercover boyfriend were alone in their tent. The entry flaps and vents were zipped shut for privacy, and inside it was totally dark. A burning lantern or flashlight would have thrown their shadows against the nylon, enabling passersby to see what they were really up to.
Can you feel it? Andy whispered.
After Steger's speech, Agent Ferguson had left the campsite to update his field contact. An hour later, he'd returned with new instructions. If something big was going to happen in the next 24 hours, as Steger had promised, then Ferguson and Andy had until morning to find out what it was. It was Andy's job to wire up and get someone from the Alliance to talk about it.
No, said Ferguson.
His hand was on her back, resting right on the covert body wire transmitter that Andy had planted under her sweater. Andy had worn a wire many times before, and she wasn't the only agent who claimed she could wire up in her sleep. Now she could add, in a dark tent.
We're good to go, said Andy.
The rumble of motorcycles outside told Andy something was up. She went to see what was going on. About a dozen riders had loaded their gear. Most of them never wore helmets, but in the darkness, Andy didn't recognize any of them. Their friend William walked past her, carrying a cooler.
Where's everybody going? Asked Andy.
William stopped.
You didn't hear?
Andy's boyfriend emerged from the tent.
Nah, we were just, you know.
William smiled a little, but it quickly faded. Somebody tried to kill one of our men in Florida.
Is he okay?
Dunno, but whoever did this won't be. Time to bust some heads. You two coming?
Where to?
Asked Andy. Santa Fe River, south of Itchituckney.
Where exactly? Asked Andy.
William gave her a look. In the darkness, Andy couldn't tell if it was one of annoyance or suspicion.
Shit, Henning, why don't you just ask him to please speak directly into the microphone?
Colt knows where, he said. Just follow. Andy and her partner exchanged glances. They were on the same page.
Sure,
said Andy.
Count us in.
Chapter 74. The viewing for Cynthia Porter was at Carter Funeral Home from 6 to 8 p.m. Jack double-checked the time on the obituaries and arrived just minutes before it ended. The parking lot was full and guests were milling about the lobby. But Jack quickly realized that they were there for the other viewing. People came and went from Parlor A, talking and greeting one another with the obligatory, "Good to see you, old friend, so sorry it's under these sad circumstances." There was none of that at the Cynthia Porter viewing. The double doors to Parlor B were wide open, welcoming guests, but all was quiet. Such was the memorial for an old woman who had outlived her husband, her friends, her siblings, and even her only child. Jack entered and stopped just inside the doorway. He saw the closed metal casket at the head of the room. A mixed flower arrangement stood on a pedestal beside it. In the first row of chairs was the only visitor, an African-American woman somewhere between the age of Jack and the deceased. She noticed his arrival, rose, and welcomed him.
"I'm Virginia, Mrs. Porter's caretaker. I know who you are," she said. "Miss Cynthia and I watch the news together every night. I hope you don't mind my coming. Would you like to pay your respects?" she said, gesturing toward the casket.
"I'm sure," said Jack. He hadn't planned his every move in advance, but this seemed like his opportunity. He reached inside his coat pocket and removed a printed copy of his letter from Cynthia.
"I'd be grateful if you would read this,"
he said, and he placed it in Virginia's hands. Virginia seemed to recognize it.
"I was right there in her kitchen when Miss Porter wrote this to you.
Have you read it?"
"No, sir. I put it in the mail for her."
"Read it, please," said Jack. She didn't say she would, and Jack didn't give her time to say she wouldn't. He went to the casket and waited with his back to Virginia. The framed photograph atop the closed casket was that of a beautiful young woman. In her sweet smile, however, Jack saw a tortured soul. Her heart had been a vault since childhood, holding the secret of her taboo affection for Willie James, and then, for the rest of her life, the horrible secret of his murder. It was such a different world then, Jack would have liked to think. But then he thought of Shelley and Jamal, and it seemed that some differences were merely a matter of degree. Jack turned, suddenly sensing that Virginia was standing behind him. Her eyes were dark, wet pools. Jack wasn't sure if the tears were for Willie James or Cynthia. Maybe both.
"Have you talked to Kelvin, cousin?" she asked.
Virginia had zeroed in on the issue at hand.
"No," said Jack. "I haven't been able to reach him, and I'm not sure he'd talk to me anyway. I'm the lawyer for the man accused of killing his great-grandson."
"He's in town for the trial, you know. The whole cousin family is."
"That's what I understand."
Jack didn't tell her about the nonverbal exchange between Kelvin and Shelley in the courtroom.
I'm sure Miss Cynthia would not have mentioned Calvin by name in her letter if it wasn't important to her. That's why I came to you. I was hoping that I would speak to Calvin. Jack knew it was a lot to ask anyone to contact a member of the victim's family on his behalf, but he'd run out of viable alternatives. Yes. Would you? Virginia looked toward the casket. Miss Cynthia didn't really have a last wish. I guess this was it. So yes, she said, her gaze shifting back to Jack. I will help you. If I can.
Chapter 75. Percy was near the river. Which river? He had no idea. Moonlight glistened off black water made blacker by cover of night. He was deep in the wilderness, surrounded by scrub pine and cypress trees, no roads in sight, not even a footpath. The shed in which he'd been held captive was adjacent to a small boathouse, accessible only by boat or off-road vehicle, though he'd seen neither since his escape. He'd walked as far as he could with his ankles shackled. When he reached what felt like a safe distance from the shed, he stopped along the riverbank to cut through the chain. This river looked wider than what he remembered of the Itchituckni, but maybe that was because he was farther downriver. Or maybe it was another river entirely. Maybe he wasn't even in Florida anymore, who knew? He had to break the chain, or he might well die in the middle of nowhere. He decided that one cut in the middle would be easier than two at each ankle, even if it did mean dragging around the length of rattling chain from each foot. He worked furiously. Cutting through the wood stud in the shed had been easier than this. He worried that the scrape of the hacksaw might carry all the way back to the shed. What if Hatchet Head regained consciousness and came looking for him? Should have killed him. Percy should have just split that fucking head in half when he'd had the chance. But that wasn't who Percy was. Percy sawed faster. After 20 minutes of constant work, he was only halfway through the steel link. Sweat pasted his shirt to his body, and every muscle in his arm was burning. He fell back in the weeds, exhausted, and then in the moonlight spotted a large rock by the river. He tossed the hacksaw aside and crawled on hands and knees to the rock. Taking the hatchet from the shed had been a good idea. With one well-placed chop, a direct hit to the weakened link, he was free. Yes! He was a new man. Chains still dangled from his ankles and wrists, but he could run now if he had to, had he known where he was going. Heading back in the direction of the shed wasn't an option. He continued downriver along the bank. His eyes were well adjusted to the night, but even so, he walked straight into low-hanging branches. Several jabbed him hard enough to break the skin and draw blood. He soldiered on, but he was growing weaker. He'd burned more calories in the last 2 hours than he'd consumed in the last... how long was it, 5 days? More. Hatchet Head had told him that the FBI was in the area. He was tempted to call out for help, but again, he worried that a gang of racists might answer him. What he needed was perspective. A view from above to get the lay of the land. A poplar tree ahead looked suitable. He pulled himself up and climbed until the limbs were no longer big enough to support his weight. The forest was overgrown, so he didn't get much of a view, but he swore he saw a light burning a few hundred yards ahead. A campsite, maybe? Percy climbed down from the tree. At ground level, he could no longer see the light through the forest, but he had his general bearings. He would approach with caution, but the rattle of his chains would make it hard to go unnoticed. He started through the brush, walking in what he thought was the right direction. Just ahead, he saw the light again, but it wasn't a campsite.
It was a shack in a clearing, and the window was aglow. His pulse quickened as he moved toward it. He reached the clearing and stopped about 20 yards from the house. It was made of old, unpainted pine and had a sagging tin roof. There couldn't have been more than 2 or 3 rooms inside. The light in the window flickered, which told him that it was probably from a kerosene lamp. There were no power lines connected to the house, so if it had electricity, it was from a generator, which definitely wasn't running at the moment. The night was completely still, quiet enough for Percy to hear the whoosh of the flowing river. Percy took another step forward and then stopped short, realizing that he was standing amid a plot of grave markers. 8 dead O'Connells, the oldest born in 1909. Someone had lived in this shack a long time. Someone was still living there.
"Man!" a woman shouted from inside the house. "There's a nigger in our yard!"
"What?"
Ben grumbled.
"And he's wearing shackles! Must have escaped from a chain gang!"
Percy wanted a shout out in his own defense. "No, no, you've got it all wrong! I need help!" The front door flew open, and out came Big Ben, armed with a shotgun.
"No!"
Percy screamed, but the blast of the shotgun followed. Percy was hit in the leg. How many times he didn't know, but it was bad enough to knock him to the ground. His thigh burned, and the pain made him dizzy, but he pushed himself from the ground and made one last plea.
"Don't shoot!
You got 10 seconds to get off my land!"
"Okay, be cool.
He was silenced by the unmistakable sound of a shotgun racking. Percy turned and raced across the clearing toward the river. Arms pumping and chains rattling, he ran through the pain. Another blast of the shotgun cut through the night. Percy was at full speed when he launched himself from the bank, diving headfirst and disappearing into the river as the buckshot flew overhead. He forced himself to stay under as long as he could, swimming in total darkness. It seemed like forever, but he was without air for only a minute. When he surfaced, the light from the shack was a fuzzy little ball way upriver. The current had done most of the work for him, taking him to safety. Percy rolled over and floated on his back, staring up at the stars. The cold water felt good in his leg wound. Hypothermia was possible, he knew, not to mention shock. He needed to swim ashore. But he let himself have this moment. He didn't know where the river was taking him, but he knew what was behind him. The current was his friend. His only friend.
Chapter 76.
"You can come in, Jack," said Virginia.
Jack was standing in the hallway outside Kelvin Cousins' hotel room, and Virginia was inside holding the door open. The media had reported that Jamal's parents were staying at a private residence with friends of Leroy Highsmith, but the extended family, uncles, aunts, grandparents, and great-grandfather Kelvin, were at the Hampton Inn. Virginia had contacted him as Cynthia Porter's caretaker and taken him the letter. Jack had been waiting almost 30 minutes.
"He'll talk to me?" asked Jack. "Yes."
Jack entered and Virginia closed the door. The room was a suite for business travelers, and Kelvin was in the living area beyond the kitchenette, seated in an overstuffed armchair. He reached for his walking cane as Jack approached.
"Don't get up, please," said Jack.
Kelvin Cousin nodded in appreciation of the reprieve from etiquette. The men shook hands, and Jack expressed how grateful he was for the chance to talk to someone who knew something about Willie James Howard.
"What I know is secondhand. You understand?"
said Kelvin, speaking in a voice that cracked with age.
"Who told you about Willie James?"
"Cynthia Porter," She called the Florida State Conference for the NAACP. I worked there and was the only one in the office that day. I answered the phone.
When was this?
Oh, I'd say 1950, 51, maybe.